Live to see it, friends, and welcome to The World Transformed. This program is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead, one that will be here sooner than you think, and one that you have an important role to play in bringing about. At The World Transformed, we want to introduce you to what may be the greatest transformation of them all, the one that begins with considering and acting on the almost limitless possibilities that lie before us, and that ends somewhere beyond the reach of the human imagination. So, when does this amazing future begin? Well, today is the day. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I am super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
Man, I am doing great. Doing great.
Hey, happy Monday, huh? Here we are back on Monday night, where we belong, right?
That's right. We've had a couple of weeks where, you know, it was like, okay, we're doing Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday this week, or even Wednesday, Thursday, Friday one week. It's good to, you know, we need to space it out correctly. I think Monday, Wednesday, Friday is ideal when we can manage it. So
when we can do it. It is the ideal. I agree. It's, you know, it gives everybody just enough world transformed. You get your kind of micro doses, 30 minutes. Monday, you know, because the work week has just started again. You need that to keep you going. Wednesday, get you over the hump. And then Friday, let's celebrate, huh? Other geek. And, you know, it's the perfect placement of material. So
well, signs of the times.
We do it for you, the home listener, once again. What's that?
That's right. Signs of the times this week, right?
All week we're looking at signs of the times. And we've got a great show tonight talking about future scenarios coming true. But before we get there, I thought let's take a moment and reflect on, I would say, the really big news from last week, which would be the passing of John Glenn. Everyone should know John Glenn, in addition to being a U.S. senator, and in later life, one of the astronauts on the space shuttle, was a Mercury astronaut and the first American in orbit.
And right.
Also, quite the hero in World War II, fighter pilot or bomber. I'm not sure. He was a pilot who flew many missions with, I just learned this past week, Ted Williams, interestingly enough, who was his wingman. So he had this career as a Marine aviator leading up to becoming a Mercury astronaut, became the first man in orbit, and I don't know, what can you say about John Glenn? Just an amazing guy all the way around, huh?
Yeah, I mean, you know, he was not the first American astronaut. I believe that was Alan Shepard, right?
But Shepard was first American in space. That's right, and we should not forget that.
His was a suborbital flight.
Grissom as well. Yeah,
yeah, and that's right. And then, when Glenn went up, he had an orbital flight. And they intended to take a few more trips around the planet, didn't they, with that particular flight? But they brought him in early because they saw some problems, and they weren't 100% sure they were going to get him back. It was a dangerous flight, going to space is dangerous. You know, let's face it. But it was kind of touch and go there, getting him home.
It shows you kind of how rough and tumble things were back in those days, because that was the first manned NASA flight that wasn't just an arc, right? That wasn't just the rocket's going up and the rocket's coming right back down again, right? It was the first mission of any duration at all where he orbited the Earth. I think he was supposed to orbit 5, 6, 7 times, something like that. He ended up orbiting 3 times before they noticed some equipment problems. There was a problem with how the landing bag was deployed, and they were afraid that whatever was not right, not in the correct position for it, would only get worse if they let it go any longer. So they pulled him out of orbit after 3 orbits. But obviously he the craft landed and everything worked out okay. But it just goes to show you, you know, the first time there was any possibility of something really going wrong, something almost did, right? Says a lot about
there's a lot that has to go right, and and disaster only requires like one thing to go wrong, right? So they have to get it right every time. So he was the last of the Mercury 7. They're all gone now. The original Mercury 7 astronauts are 7 up.
And you know, he was the oldest.
He was the oldest one.
Time of the Mercury 7, he was the old man of those seven.
Yeah,
interesting. Yeah. And he lived longer than any of them, and that's something.
And well, one of the reasons that he bowed out from the space program, you know, the others tended to stay on for at least Gemini, right?
Right.
Deke Slayton couldn't really fly, so he ended up becoming the head of the whole program for years. But you know, the rest of them, you know, Alan Shepard went to the moon finally, and Grissom would have been on the one of the first missions to the moon. But Glenn, you know, he kind of saw that, well, maybe he was on the long in the tooth end of this thing, and you know, time to pursue other things. So he goes and becomes a United States Senator, which was really I don't know, just a truly a career dedicated to public service. I mean, I think you can, you can say that about him when I'm not comfortable saying about it politicians these days.
Well, if the portrayal of Glenn in The Right Stuff is accurate, and unfortunately that's how we, you know, that's how we get to know people a lot of times, is from works of semi-fiction, right? Well, I think perhaps his decision to go into politics might have been part of a concern for his wife, and you know, had he gone out there and gotten himself killed in a mission, and you know, he wouldn't be around to take care of her, and so she had some special issues that I think he wanted to stick around for, so you know, be there for her. So I think that must have been part of his concern. And,
yeah, well, he obviously totally devoted to his wife. Another interesting aspect about him, you look at the divorce rate amongst the astronauts, not a good thing, right? In fact, they make a big deal out of it in Apollo 13, that of all the Apollo astronauts, you know, the only two that were still married at the time of that movie was made the guy's name has slipped my mind, the character that Tom Hanks plays, I apologize, famous Apollo astronaut, but... yeah, you know, 73 years. John and Andy Glenn were married. Pretty amazing. So, inspirational person. President Obama said he inspired generations of scientists, engineers, and astronauts who will take us to Mars and beyond, not just to visit but to stay. That great quote from the president there, and I think if that's John Glenn's legacy, that's a great legacy to have. And I think that's true.
Jim Lovell. I'm sorry.
Oh, thank you. It was on the
Tom Hanks
brain
Jim Lovell.
Somewhere. Thank you.
Yeah, it took me a second. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Apollo 8, Jim Lovell. Thank you. Yes.
Yeah.
But if 13. when we get to Mars, you know, John Glenn, the Mercury 7 astronauts, and John Glenn will be people that will be remembered, right? I mean, everything we do in space, this is their legacy that they helped get us there.
You know, my thought when these old heroes die is that it seems to me it's kind of a reminder we need to get back out there, right? I mean, we need to be pushing on this frontier. You know, these heroes are a limited resource. Right, and we need to be making new ones, and we just need to get back out there and be doing stuff, because hey, these old guys are not getting any younger, and would really, you know, we need to get back out there and give and win one for the Gipper every now and then, right?
So, well, indeed, I mean, I'll tell you that there's something very poignant about that New York Times headline, "American Hero of the Space Age." It's very sad to me whenever I see that phrase used. It rarely gets used anymore. But when I was a kid, you know, when Gemini and Apollo were happening, and Skylab and all that stuff, the space age was the present and the future. And now, clearly, they're using that term to refer to something a long time ago. And that just seems so strange to me that the space age is the past. There's something very wrong about that, isn't there?
Yeah, yeah. And fortunately, it's not going to stay in the past. The second space age will be quite a bit different.
Yeah.
But it'll be, you know, I think at the forefront will be private industry, and going for a profit, and that's the reason we will go and stay. These you know, these original the original space age was just to go and plant flags and say we were, you know, we got there.
I think that's right. I think there will be commercial reasons to go, and it'll be something that will be open to a much broader range of people, you know.
Right.
The original space age was really an enterprise for the two big superpowers in the world. Increasingly, in the new space age, it'll be something regular people.
It gave us an opportunity to battle the Soviets without having to shed blood. And that's a good thing. You know, you could go to war without having to kill anybody, which is really what we were doing.
Yeah, it was a front of the Cold War, as has been argued, and I think that's correct. Yeah.
Yeah. So
anyway, our program this evening is Signs of the Times, Future Scenarios Coming True. So all I've done is I've taken some headlines and I've said, well, see, this is evidence that a particular big scenario for the future is coming true. And for our first one, we've each got stories around this. We don't have linked stories. We've got stories from our own personal lives. This occurred to me yesterday. I've got this beautiful computer table. It's about probably, I don't know, 12, 13 years old. It's made of glass. It was purchased at the same time as an iMac, and it was all set up for that. But you could use it for anything, right? It's kind of modular, and it's got one section for just putting the iMac on, and then it's got this nice long just desk area that you can work on. It's kind of big and heavy. It's made of glass and metal, so it's this almost sort of futuristic looking thing. And we don't need it anymore. I work at a stand-up desk. My wife's got a desk that fits perfectly in her nook, and it's just taking up all this room in the closet. And so we finally say, well, let's give this away. And nobody will take this thing, right? I mean,
you can't get it down to Goodwill or anything?
No, they're not interested. She called the Salvation Army, and they were like, well, we can only pick up a desk if it's an antique. And I'm like, wow, think how picky the Salvation Army has become. And there's an economic change. There was a time in my neighborhood, and I assume all across the country, but certainly in the subdivision where I live, that anything you wanted to get rid of, you put out with your trash a couple hours before the trash came on a Monday, and there were people who would come by with like pickup trucks, and they would, you know, if it was anything of any value at all, they would then take it to the flea market, right? I mean, it was just it's like you're supporting their business. They don't exist anymore. Somewhere in the last I don't relate them necessarily, but somewhere during the Obama years, this practice ceased, right? I don't know when it happened. I can't point to a year and say, we don't get to do this anymore. But I started looking around the neighborhood, and it's like people would leave stuff out, and it's still there. You know, we hadn't tried it, but I'm like, I'm not lugging that thing out to the curb just to have the, you know, just to have the scavengers tell me that it's not worth their trouble. That would be really frustrating. So I think later this week, my son-in-law and I are going to try to sneak it into Goodwill. You know, just kind of like leave it there. It's almost an act of vandalism as much as it is.
leave it in their parking lot, and then they've got a problem. You know?
But I mean that tells you something, right? About the state of where we are for manufactured goods. Right, the market for them is just not what it was. Items like this are produced so cheaply, and yet of such durable quality that it's like you got to keep it. Right, nobody wants it. Right, I suppose I could get somebody to buy it on eBay if I paid for the shipping. I don't know, but the options for unloading something like this are much less than they used to be, and I think it's because everybody who has a desk needs a desk has one or can get one much more easily than was the case in the past. And to me, that is a small data point, but kind of an important one, showing that we really are living in an age that's past scarcity. At least where computer desks are concerned. What do you think?
I saw something funny that's very close to this that was on Facebook. I think it was about a week or so ago, Phil. It was the first picture was a picture of, outside someone's dorm room at college, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And it was a full-size monitor. We're talking the old style, not the new flat screens. This was, one of the big tube monitors
Yep.
for a computer. And on the side of it was a little placard that says that, you know, it says free, you know, free.
Yeah.
And it was sitting outside of someone's door. And then the second picture is, you know, somebody had taken it and moved it to another, in front of another another door, their own door. You know, someone
yeah.
in that dorm took it to another floor and then flipped the card over and wrote $5. Put it further. Now, the funny thing is, you know, what, you know, the third picture could be in this series could be slashed through and put free again, because he may have bought himself a problem.
If, right.
You know, because who wants these old monitors anymore, right? So he may not be able to get $5 for that in front of
yeah.
him anymore. So. Any rate, that's
yeah. Presumably, with monitors, there is some way to recycle computer equipment. I think, right?
Yeah,
I haven't
yeah.
really worked on it lately. I'm actually going to, because I think I'm getting a new desktop computer for Christmas. But that'll be my next problem. I'll write about that. How do you get rid of a perfectly, you know, fairly good, like 7-year-old computer? Right? What do you do with that? And it's a big
HP
power.
Well, I mean, even if you're just talking just the components inside of it, I mean, there's a little bit of gold, and especially in the older computers, there's.
Oh, there you go. Yeah.
You know, I mean, if nothing else, you know, get the gold. You know, so that's funny, but yeah, you know, I was as an industry repair. At least locally, Phil, here in the Shreveport area, there used to be repair guys that would, if you had a broken down TV or a computer or something like that, you'd take it to them, pay them a little money and come pick up your repaired television or whatever. I mean, nowadays, if your TV does go out, it seems like they don't, you know, they last a little longer. You don't,
right.
They're not going down as often as they used to. You know, no one's using a tube TV anymore, and the tubes required, you know, you had to replace the tubes every now and then, do this and that, kind of as just general maintenance. You don't have that anymore. And so when these things do go down, I mean, they're out with the trash, right?
Exactly.
No one bothers to get these things repaired. And to some extent, that includes computers, too. So as an industry, repair, at least around here, I mean, what about in the Denver area? Have you seen it pretty much that industry die?
Oh, I think that's true. I mean, you know, if your fridge breaks, right, you can get a guy to work on that, right? You know, or your
yeah.
washer, dryer, that kind of stuff. But things that we're used to in previous generations or even just a few years ago that you would have had somebody fixed, I think there's just kind of an assumption you just replace stuff now.
Yeah.
That you don't get it fixed. And yeah, I think there's a whole level of repair that just doesn't occur anymore. I one example, this is a weird one. It's seemingly trivial, but it comes from my own life. As I was putting out Christmas lights last week, or week before last, I had a whole string go down and I realized that it had to be the fuses and the cord. It wasn't just a single light. And I've been doing this long enough, you know, I know how to, like, pull the fuses out and put new fuses in the cord, because it's like, that string of lights cost me $3.99, you know, so $3.99 for 100 lights. I probably bought it 3 years ago, so I'm not, you know, I'm not giving up that easy.
Out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. But I think they're priced so low now that that's what everybody does, right? They don't even bother
yeah.
to, like, go through and check and see if there's going to be a bulb. They just, you know, they throw it out. Because the idea of fixing it yourself or getting somebody to fix it, either way, just isn't part of the mindset much anymore. Although I've seen...
they probably don't even manufacture it to where it's easy to fix anymore, Bill.
Right.
Those lights probably, they don't even fix it to where you can change the bulb. If it goes out, you're expected to throw it away. So.
Well, they still, you know what? They still pack extra fuses and extra bulbs with every... But I think it's the gum with the baseball cards, you know. I mean, people just throw that away. They don't even look at it. They don't even know what they're getting. And I've got this
yeah.
box in my basement full of spare lights and fuses, right? So I'm like, I know what to do. I'm ready to go. And we'll get to that, because that actually kind of goes to another future scenario that we'll talk about a little bit on, I think, on Wednesday's show. We'll get to that. But, hey, you know what? We're going to run out of time, and we've still got...
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry, did we cover, did you have anything else you wanted to say about the death?
No, that's good. Let's get to this guy who was paralyzed. This is fascinating to me.
Yeah, okay, so there's post-scarcity. How about regenerative medicine? I mean, if you want to see evidence that we've entered the era of that, read this story, right? A paralyzed man treated with stem cells now has regained upper body movement. According to the story, this stem cell treatment, which is the first of its kind ever to be used on a human being, I believe we've talked about this once before, this story.
Right.
He recovered 2 spinal cord levels. Okay, so, you know, and I don't know the gradations, you know, but I'm assuming it's a scale like the Richter scale or something like that in terms of how paralyzed you are, right? And however many there are, I can't help but imagine that getting 2 of them back is huge, right? I mean, it's just...
Well, he was a full quadriplegic. The doctors had told he and his family that, hey, you're not going to ever have any function below the neck.
Right.
And with what they were able to do for him, he was able to recover a significant portion of his, of his upper body. And what a huge difference that can make in your life, because, I mean, instead of just literally laying there with no ability to take care of yourself at all, you know, if you can move your arms even just a little bit, amazing things can be done as far to allow you to be self-sufficient at that point.
Right.
You know, if you have any arm movement at all, you can more easily control your, you know, the wheelchair you're in. You can do things to help take care of yourself and to be independent, and that's huge for patients like this. And so,
well, absolutely. I mean, it's the difference between, you know, he would have had to have been wheeled out of there or in a really expensive wheelchair that he's operating with his head or his eyes or something like that. We've talked about those kinds of devices.
Or something like, or, yeah, they have like some devices that allow them to allow these patients to control it with like a little joystick with his tongue or something.
Yeah. You see the picture of him here with a barbell, right? He's lifting, yeah. He's lifting some weights. So he, you know, presumably has enough strength he can operate his own chair, or will get there eventually.
Yeah.
And you know, one of the statements in this is that the doctors can't make any promises that his condition will further improve. Well, I'll tell you what, if I was this guy, I would not only be I think really grateful for what they've done, but I'd be pretty optimistic about my chances this point. It's, you know, if in 2016 they're able to do this, who knows what they'll be doing for people in the lower body by 2021, say. I mean, obviously that's, you know, it's having to wait a while, but to me, this is just so encouraging for so many people that they were able to do something like this. I hope that we see a lot more of this in the near future.
Well, I've been close to and been around people that with paralysis, including a quadriplegic, and Phil, it's just, I mean, it is one of the saddest things. I mean, you just absolutely, you're a prisoner really at that point.
Yeah,
and,
exactly.
To allow these people the opportunity to regain some independence is just so huge. It's such a life-affirming kind of thing for these people, and I'm so grateful for news like this. This is awesome.
Really, really encouraging stuff. And since we're running short on time, we just got to jump to our final scenario that's coming true. I tried to separate post-scarcity and post-employment with the regenerative medicine. That would have been a great story to leave for the end, actually, because it's such a hopeful story. But how about this? Silicon Valley CEO, people are lashing out because technology is destroying more and more jobs. This has become such a common, prominent theme lately. You know, I just read that book, The Economic Singularity, and I think just the awareness of this is really beginning to sink in. I think we as a society are just a couple of years away from really starting to deal with this as something we're nationally aware of, right? Rather than something that people sort of hint around about it, or people like us, you know, warn about it. And it's interesting in the news story that they say that this may have contributed to Donald Trump's surprise victory in the U.S. presidential election. I think maybe it did. I think it's one of the things that that may have contributed to just a kind of a dissatisfaction with status quo thinking around how the economy works. And I think going forward, we were kind of war gaming the Clinton campaign last week. Going forward, if this isn't part of your agenda, if this isn't part of your platform when you're running for national office, you're going to be at a severe disadvantage. I think that that this is something that the incoming presidential administration is going to have to be thinking about and looking at, and it's something that individuals need to be thinking about looking at, business needs to be thinking about looking at, because this is real. This is either happening now or it's about to happen in a really big way.
And I don't know that this problem is going to get any better, Phil. You know, automation is going to make this problem worse. And, you know, that's the thing about automation. You don't have to pay a machine the way you pay humans to do the same work. And so, the answers can't just be, well, we just, we'll have retraining programs or welfare. Those are, that's not the same as the sort of, thing as having a job to go to right now. You know, I mean,
yeah.
And so these people cannot be ignored politically. They just cannot be. And so I think he's absolutely right about that. That this was a employment based election. And I think that was something missed by the media and by Hillary Clinton's campaign to some extent. So I think that's exactly right. And again, I don't know that there's much that could be done by the incoming administration to stop the trends. If you're a person that depends on work in the in coal industries or things like that, and manual labor type situations, I mean, it might be time to consider retraining on the side while you still have your job, to get ready to do something else, because I don't know that the long term outlook on things on industry based jobs like that is all that great.
Well, I think that you're right. The shift is very real, and how we shift and where it goes is uncertain. But even for example, I saw a headline yesterday, which we could have added here. I guess Carrier, the company in Indiana that was going to move to Mexico and is staying there, and so a couple thousand jobs got saved in Indiana. Yay! It turns out one of their big plans is to pretty much automate all those jobs out of existence anyhow. Right. They were going to do it in Mexico. Now they're going to do it in Indiana. But, even if your heart's in the right place and you want to create a lot of jobs, right?
And let's not put like little twirly mustaches on the executives of Carrier. It's not like, they're these bad guys that are just wanting to put people on the street. If you fail to either outsource or automate, you are left in the dirt by those who do, right?
Right.
The whole company will be gone then. I mean, Carrier would be a historical footnote if it doesn't, if it ignores the trends, right? So, I don't know. This is a tough one.
That's discussed, we'll have to do a show about it. You should read The Economic Singularity, and we'll do a show talking about it. But one of the things that's talked about there is this road to eventual, universal basic income. The author is not ideologically inclined to like that idea. It's kind of like us, the old kicking and screaming. That's where we end up. But what's interesting is if that is where we end up, there's this path that gets us there. And I think we're going to try a lot of different things first, and some new ideas are going to be introduced. I was real interested to read a couple weeks ago about swinging it back to our earlier topic. People are setting up what they call repair cafes. People are beginning to get together and fix their own stuff. Which kind of ties to both of those topics is like, well, there's plenty of stuff around and nobody to fix it anymore, but I've got time on my hands, maybe because I don't have a job, and I can start fixing my stuff myself. Post-scarcity is going to play into post-employment in ways that we haven't yet figured out, right, that we haven't yet predicted. This is why science fiction is so helpful, and why we'll be talking about it on Friday in Cory Doctorow's book, Makers. You know, he presents a very different kind of scenario for how we get to, you know, a post-scarcity world that has fewer and fewer people working in it. And obviously that's not a problem we can solve on the show tonight, but I think we're there, right? I think we're definitely looking we're looking down the barrel of post-employment. It's going to be something we're going to deal with.
That's right. And so, at any rate, kind of a bummer way to end it, but hey, we'll be back on Wednesday with some uplifting signs of the times, right?
We're going to talk about some amazing future scenarios on Wednesday. So great talking with you about these. Stephen, thank you all for being with us, and we will be back on Wednesday with a brand new show. Until next time, live to see it.